Hello and welcome to the February edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynemouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I am Fran Frank, and this month I am joined by Valerie Forrester, who will present the programme with me. Lovely to see you again, Valerie.
Yes, and you.
Have you been busy since I last met up with you at the Christmas party in early December?
Oh yes, and the last couple of months seem to have flown by.
When I presented the January edition with Camilla, she managed to find lots of notable events from last year. Although I have not been able to find as many items of interest for this edition, I have come across a few things that happened during the month of February in years gone by. For example, did you know that on the 2nd of February 1949, the first 45 RPM vinyl record was released? And as far as I know, although they were replaced by tapes and then by CDs, vinyl records are now coming back into use. Mind you, I think that some of the original record sleeves are also quite valuable, if they're in good condition, of course.
Now here's a notable event that most of us should be aware of, as it will have been mentioned last year during the Queen's Jubilee celebrations. February the 6th, 1952, was the day that Princess Elizabeth became Queen, following the death of her father, King George the 6th, at Sandringham.
On 21st of February 1965, Steve Fossett completed the first solo hot air balloon flight around the world. Although I enjoyed my flight across Devon a few years ago, I don't think I'd like to travel that far in a hot air balloon.
On the 6th of February 1971, an American astronaut, Alan Shepard, hit 3 golf balls on the surface of the moon. I wonder how far they travelled, and whether he bothered to pick them up again. Do we have any more interesting facts relating to previous Februaries, Fran?
Yes, Valerie. The final one I found occurred in February 2004, when Mark Zuckerberg created the social media platform Facebook and went on to become a multimillionaire. Just shows what technology can lead to. Well, I suppose we ought to move on with this month's recording. What have we got coming up in the programme, Valerie?
Jenny Jenkins recently met up with one of our local artists, Laura Wall, so we will include that interview, followed by Laura's choice of music. Camilla will then provide us with some general knowledge questions, just to get our brains working.
Babs Astley will read an article about wedding traditions. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will discuss one of the books they have read recently, followed by Aileen Clarkson with her letter from a dog walker.
Lorraine Ferguson reads chapter 4 of her friend's diary about their trip to Iceland.
Then it's your article about Exminster Hospital, closely followed by John Townsend sharing his memoirs of somewhere he once lived.
Sounds like a packed programme. Let's begin with Jenny's interview. Laura Wall is an artist with a pen and watercolour illustrative style, using bold, vibrant colours, depicting mainly local scenes on various items as well as pictures. The interview will be followed by Laura's choice of music, written and composed by Randy Newman for the Toy Story series of films.
Good morning. Today, dear listener, it is my great pleasure to introduce you to a young lady, an author, illustrator, and award-winning artist, Laura Wall, who many of you may know from visiting her unique art gallery here in Tynemouth. Hello, Laura, and welcome to Roundabout.
Good morning, Jenny. It's so lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. As someone once said, it's a very good place to start. Can you tell us when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Gravesend in Kent on the 17th of June in 1985, but actually on the carpet of our lounge. It was a very speedy delivery.
Well, you were certainly in a hurry to get here, but I think it must have caused your parents a lot of concern.
Yes, well, would you believe they were due to move house the next day? So my mum was a little bit concerned about the state of the carpet.
Oh my goodness, that's unusual. Can you tell me how your family happened to be in Gravesend?
Yeah, so my granddad was Irish and he moved here during the war and met my nan. They married and had my dad. He was a plumber and my mum, Jan, was a teacher. And she studied maths at uni, and I also have an elder sister called Mandy, and she's also very artistic.
Oh, that's lovely. Now, where did you go to school, Laura, and did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did actually. I went to St John's Catholic School in Gravesend, but I had such an inspirational teacher. I was so lucky. Art was my favourite subject, and my mum and my dad really nurtured that, but also this fantastic teacher helped me too, and she encouraged me to take my GCSE a year early, my art GCSE a year early, should I say.
And so why did your parents move to the southwest?
Well, my mum and dad always wanted to move to Devon. We absolutely loved Devon, but they wanted to wait for a moment where it was key in our education to move us. They didn't want to pull us out during a really important time. So between GCSE and A-level, they thought that was the opportune moment. We moved to Lifton near Launceston on the border of Devon and Cornwall.
Right. So then you were looking at colleges. So where did you go to college?
Yes, I went to St Austell College in Cornwall, and there I studied art, sociology, English literature, media studies and dance.
My goodness, that's a bucketful. So you were later encouraged to apply for a scholarship in 2003. I believe after looking at several universities you found Aberystwyth in Wales, and why did you choose to go there?
Oh, I love your pronunciation.
The actress in me, darling.
Fabulous. Well, I have to say, I went to lots of different universities for open days, and when I went to Aberystwyth, it's right on the sea, and so there's these beautiful Victorian houses, and the waves are crashing up against the promenade, and I turned to my mum and I said, "Mum, this is the place. I absolutely love it here. The sea sung to me," and also the School of Art that was there was just beautiful. It was a bit like Hogwarts, so I thought, oh yes, I could definitely see myself here.
Oh dear. And I believe that's where you wrote your first children's book, The Goose Was Hatched, as it were. That was good, wasn't it?
Yes, that was good, like that one, the golden egg. Yeah, so it was actually. So I studied fine art and illustration at university, and that's part of my project, my end of year project, was to write and illustrate a children's book. And I remember at the time being very cross about this because I thought, well, I'm doing illustration. I want to draw. I can't write a book.
Brilliant.
But actually, it was the best thing that could have happened. And I created this book, Goose, and it's inspired by my childhood with my mum, who wears the most wonderful heels. And so in the children's books, all you see are the legs and the shoes of the adults. And it's all from a child's point of view. So this is inspired by growing up, really, and just my fabulous mum.
Well, you finished with a first class honours degree. Well done, you. But what happened next? Did you go off for a gap year and travel the world?
Oh, I wish I had. Do you know, I also studied media studies as well as fine art and illustration.
Oh, yeah.
And basically, I finished university and my friend said, oh, there's a job going at a TV company in Plymouth. It's a company called 2-4. It's the biggest one outside of London.
Wow.
So I applied for it. And I only went and got the job. I couldn't believe it. And so basically 3 years of my life went to working at this TV company, which was a great experience. I was a runner and I worked my way right up to an editor assistant. You can even see my name on credits, but it wasn't quite for me.
Well, I believe you were living in Tavistock and you'd got your first home there. Then you decided to leave 2010. So I gather it wasn't very good. You were working nights and weekends, and a boyfriend who was a bit negative. So, in your words, you decided to concentrate on yourself and your future. So, that was a positive move. Which time you met your future husband, hadn't you, Dave?
So that's right, that's right.
Tell me about him. He's a bit different, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, the 2-4 days were really good for me in that it taught me a work ethic, and I worked so hard, but I wasn't happy, and basically, I met Dave through a friend of my sister, and he was so different. He's so kind, and he saw that I was an artist underneath. And basically, he encouraged me to give up my job. So I gave up the TV, and I basically started painting.
Oh, I say, well, you had a good chap there, didn't you? But I think he made you knuckle down to, what did you call it? A hard work regime?
Well, he made me a desk in my spare room.
Oh, well, that was a big hint.
Yes, and so, I mean, it was just brilliant because actually it was all about turning up for work. So between 9 and 5, I would make sure I was at that desk and painted. And I spent the first month painting, and that's, once we had a portfolio, we started going around galleries.
Oh, brilliant. So you went around, and how many galleries did you end up?
Well,
in
we...
About 20, is
it? Yes,
Devon,
that's
right. Cornwall.
Yeah, yeah, we had about 20 galleries by the end of the year, and that was out of visiting 100, so it was about a 1 in 5 success rate.
Well, that determination. You're moving on, and so you got married in 2014.
Yes, that's
That was
right.
Good. He married the boss. I shouldn't tell him that. So, also, what happened to poor Dave?
Well, he was a social worker, and he got made redundant in 2014. And I was like, brilliant, you can come back with me.
Oh, I love that. Well, I gather during this time you decided to have a break from it all, and you rented a gîte in France for a month. And what happened during that month?
Well, it was a time of reflection, to be honest with you. We just got married. He was working with me, and we really had to kind of think of an idea of how to keep the art going. And basically, we were suddenly inspired to get our own gallery. So after spending a month in France and painting and chatting and coming up with ideas, we came back and we chose Tynmouth, and we decided to try and find a little gallery, and we found one on George Street.
Oh, yes, that's where it all started. Mm. So obviously your grand plan started to fall into place. How did you get recognition and some boosting awards? How did that happen?
We started off by having a big exhibition, and that was really exciting. It was a sellout show, and we went in for some awards as well. And we won Devon's Best Art Gallery, but most excitingly, over the last few years, this year, we won National Art Retailer of the Year. So that, to us, really signified the heights of where we could go and what we've been aiming for such a long time. So it was so exciting.
Oh, dear. I've got the words muddy stiletto readers. What does that mean?
Oh, so, no, that was the one for the Devon Awards. So there's a award called the Muddy Stiletto Awards, and basically lots of Devon businesses put in for that. So was the one that won us the Devon Best Art Gallery. And then we won National Art Retailer by the Fine Art Trade Guild.
Well, awards coming thick and fast. So we've talked about the first goose story, which was hatched when you were working with your mum and university. And it was published by Ward Publications. Mm. So how did you manage to get that done?
Well, that was quite hard, actually. So I emailed, I phoned, I contacted so many publishers, and I didn't really get anywhere with any of them. And I'd heard about this London Book Fair, and it's a book fair for publishers to sell to other publishers. It's not really for the likes of authors or illustrators. And basically, I just went round the London Book Fair and gave my business card to every publisher. And then a year later, one of them contacted me and wanted to publish Goose.
Oh, that was your patience rewarded. Now, tell me about this customer who came into the gallery one day with an idea for you.
Well, they were...
Travel the world.
Yes, yes. Oh, that was amazing. They were a teacher working in Russia at the time, not at the moment. And basically, they said they have authors that come to their school to read their stories. And basically, she put me in touch with an agency. And now, me and my husband, every January, February, March, travel around the world, going to all sorts of countries.
Where have you been?
Oh, it's been so wonderful. We've been to Saudi Arabia, Thailand, Indonesia, the UAE, China. It's just been so much fun.
My goodness, I just think you're amazing. You have an energy to share with everybody, I think. How many do you have now in the Goose series?
There are 14 books now, actually, 14, and they're in 16 languages, but they're in 40 countries, which I can't believe it. It's so exciting. We went on holiday this year in Barbados, and there was a Goose book in the airport. I was like, oh my gosh.
How exciting.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
Well, I remember you telling me it's a good job you did your travelling then, because you came back just as the lockdown had started.
Yes.
COVID and the lockdown. So how on earth did you manage?
Well, that was a real life change, because obviously we couldn't travel anymore. And when we literally got back from Cambodia in March 2020, and we went into the lockdown, and I basically painted my heart out at home.
Oh, goodness. Did you have a help from the government, like other businesses?
Yes,
to support you?
We did, and thank goodness for that. The government gave us a £10,000 grant, which they gave to every small business with a bricks and mortar. I said to Dave, if we've got any hope of getting people back into our gallery, we really need to do something radical. So we invested a lot of that grant into new stock. So we bought out umbrellas and kitchenware. So then once we opened back up again, we had all this fantastic new products, and it brought people in. It was amazing.
Well, I think it was probably the busiest time for you, wasn't it?
Getting
stuff ready to send out and that sort of thing.
We certainly didn't sit back on our laurels. We really did just work. And that second lockdown especially, we were working about 15 hours a day. And that was all had to be done by postal, so we were packaging up things and offering free local delivery, and just, you know,
How many hours do you have in your day? A normal person works 9 to 5, but I don't think you ever go to sleep.
No time for sleep, Jenny.
Oh, no. Well, I just wanted to get on to what are your future plans?
Well, do you know, I was talking to Dave about this just this week. We're finally at a wonderful point where we're happy. We're out of the awful lockdowns, and I know there's uncertainty, but if we can keep where we are, where we can travel to lovely schools around the world and have our wonderful gallery and keep bringing out new products, we'll be very, very happy with that.
Well, that's a lovely thing to hear. Before we come to the end, unfortunately time rushes on, I just wanted to hear a little story that you told me about your father's rise to fame as an incident when you had a troublesome washing machine. We'll have a little brief story about that.
Yes, so my dad is a YouTube sensation. He has a plumbing YouTube channel, and it's called Derriton33, and basically on this channel he just talks through plumbing problems. And it all evolved 10 years ago. He was fixing my washing machine, couldn't work out how to fix it, and my husband said, have you gone on YouTube? Let's Google it or YouTube it. And he did, and he couldn't believe it, that this video was there to help fix it. So then he was driving back home and had this epiphany moment of, my goodness me, this would be fantastic.
I can do that.
He said, I have years of knowledge, and lo and behold, he did it, and he beavered away, and now he's got over 100,000 subscribers, and it's just crazy.
Well, how about that then? But now we've come to our closing moment, when I have to ask you if you had a choice of music that you'd like us to play you out with, and the reason why you've chosen it, please,
yes.
Laura.
So I thought You've Got a Friend in Me would be a really nice one to go out in, and that's because it's very much the friendship in my Goose books. The Goose books are all about a little girl called Sophie and her friend Goose, and they are very loyal friends, so that's why.
Well, that's a really nice piece of music I've yet to enjoy, so thank you for that. Sadly, time has run out, and I have to say a huge thank you, Laura, who I've occasionally called Lorna, Laura, for sparing the time out of your very, very full day to come and talk to us on Roundabout. And so all that's left me to say, us to say, is goodbye to our listener. So goodbye.
Oh, goodbye.
Thank you.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and your miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you got a friend in me. got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got trouble, and I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, see it through, 'cause you've got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. Now some other folks might be a little bit smarter than I am, big and stronger too, maybe, but none of them will ever love you the way I do. It's me and you, boy, and as the years go by, our friendship will never die. You're gonna see it's our destiny. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
And now, Camilla with some general knowledge questions.
1. Which city is known as the capital of the Scottish Highlands? A. Aberdeen. B. Inverness. Or C. Edinburgh. 2. Which game is thought to have been invented in 1875 by a British Army officer stationed in India? A. Cricket. B. Badminton. Or C. Snooker. 3. Frittata means omelette in which language? A. Italian. B. Spanish. Or C. French. 4. How many people usually make up a jury for a criminal trial in England and Wales? A. 10. B. 7. Or C. 12. 5. What do you call a person who climbs tall structures such as chimneys in order to carry out repairs? A. Chimney sweep. B. Steeplejack. Or C. Lumberjack. 6. Which musical instrument gets its name from the Hawaiian words for jumping flea? A. Guitar. B. Ukulele. Or C. Violin. 7. What is the collective noun for a group of owls? A. Flock. B. Gaggle. Or C. Parliament. 8. Which of these is not a Charles Dickens character? A. Obadiah Slope. B. Daniel Quilp. Or C. John Jarndyce. 9. Which of the following classical composers was born first? A. Mozart. B. Beethoven. Or C. Bach. 10. Which of the following is not named after a person? A. Tuxedo. B. Bloomers. Or C. Wellington boots. I will be back later in the programme with the answers.
Now we have an article from Babs Astley about wedding traditions.
Hello. I've had my rescue cat, Angus, for a year now, and he rarely leaves my side, so I have to apologise if he tries to combine his little meows with my talking. As I'm recording this at home, it's quite likely that this will happen, so I'm sorry about that. Everyone loves a wedding day tradition, but where do they come from? Bread or cake has been part of celebration food since medieval times. The bride and groom had to try to kiss over the pile of cakes to guarantee their future prosperity. But the traditional wedding cake as we now know it originated at the wedding of Prince Leopold, Duke of Albany, in 1882. And when Queen Victoria used white icing on her 1840 wedding cake, it gained a whole new title, Royal Icing. The tradition of messman originates from Anglo-Saxon England. Then a groom would take along his most trusted and strongest friend to help him fight any resistance from the bride's family. The popular expression tying the knot comes from the pagan tradition of hand fasting, a historical term for betrothal or wedding, in which the bride and groom would have their hands tied with cord or ribbon for the ceremony to symbolise the union. Wedding ring finger. The ancient Greeks believed that there was a vein that connected this finger directly to the heart. Technically, all veins lead to the heart, but it's a lovely thought and a worldwide tradition. Brides in Roman times wore veils to ward off evil spirits. We have the Victorians to thank for heavy long white ones. These came into vogue in the 1860s. The more ostentatious the veil, the bigger the status symbol. When Queen Victoria married Prince Albert in 1840, she wore white because it was the colour of her favourite lace. Victoria set the trend for brides in the future, helped by the colour's association with purity. And the fact that white was a status symbol, only the wealthy could afford to have it washed. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, and a silver sixpence in your shoe. It's a much-loved rhyme which dates back years, but brides still cherish it today. The wedding favour was started by European nobility in the 16th century. They would hand out small boxes of sugar, an expensive and rare delicacy at the time, as a show of wealth and to thank guests for attending. As sugar became more commonplace, it was succeeded by sugar-coated almonds. The traditional haul of five represents health, wealth, happiness, fertility, and a long life. The tradition of having bridesmaids started in Roman times, when brides would have 10 witnesses dressed identically to them. The idea was that the bridesmaid would act as decoys to evil spirits trying to harm the bride. The lookalikes were also supposed to give the bride extra protection should a rejected suitor try to kidnap her. Here's my cat agreeing with everything I say, if you can hear him. In Britain, throwing grains of rice at newlyweds goes back to pagan weddings, when it was seen as a symbol of fertility. It was the Victorians who first used shredded paper, and the word confetti is an Italian word, used for a type of sugared almond tossed into the air during special occasions. It is traditional and thought to be good luck for the bride to throw her wedding bouquet backwards over her shoulder towards the guests when she leaves for the honeymoon. The one who catches it is supposed to be the next one married. It's good luck for the groom not to see the dress before the wedding day, and considered even luckier if he doesn't turn around as the bride walks down the aisle. Traditionally, it was considered better for a couple to exchange vows as the clock's minute hand was ascending towards heaven, that is, upwards, though this isn't actually strictly observed any longer. Legend says single women will dream of their future husbands if they sleep with a slice of wedding cake under their pillows. Sounds a bit soggy if you ask me. The beautiful tradition of giving the newlyweds a piece of coal so they might have warmth, a bar of soap so that they may stay clean, and salt so they may always have food, has sadly fallen by the wayside. The tradition of giving a wooden spoon dates back many years and was supposed to help the new bride in producing the best meals for her husband. A rolling pin is another alternative, although whether that's to help with baking or keep the husband under control, I'm not sure. The tradition of throwing coins to crowds of children assembled outside the church, known as the Wedding Day Scramble, in order to share wealth and prosperity, is a lovely one, but not widely in use any longer. These are wedding traditions that haven't stood the test of time. It was always thought that the groom carrying the bride over the threshold protected her from any evil spirits lurking in their new home. But sadly, this romantic tradition has all but died out. If the bride stepped on the groom's feet, she was supposed to have the upper hand in the marriage. Likewise, she would always be considered the dominant partner if she was the first one to make a purchase after the wedding. And finally, having a kiss from a chimney sweep might not be the number one priority for most brides leaving the church or registry office nowadays, but believe it or not, it used to be considered extremely good luck to receive the kiss of luck from a sweep. Legend has it that when King George II's carriage horses bolted, the only person who attempted to stop them was a brave chimney sweep. By royal decree, the king proclaimed that all sweeps were bearers of good luck. Well, that's given you some food for thought, and I am really sorry about my cat butting in all the time, but he does, as I say, he rarely leaves my side, and so I just have to put up with it. Anyway, Happy New Year to you all. Bye.
Having worked in a register office for quite a few years, I found that very interesting. Moving on, we now have Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor, who have been reading The Penguin Lessons by Tom Mitchell. Books are available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobooks.
This month, Mary and I have been reading a little memoir. It's by someone called Tom Mitchell, and it's called The Penguin Lessons. It was published in 2015, but it's all about what this chap got up to in the 1970s when he was young. And he went to Argentina and he taught in a upmarket boarding school in the suburbs of Buenos Aires. And while he was there, he adopted a Magellan penguin.
Somewhat accidentally.
Yes, a tiny little penguin, not a big giant one, one that would just about come up to your knee. And he rescues it from an oil slick and cleans it up and takes it back and it adopts it, essentially, and it becomes part of his life and part of the school. And the book is really all about his life with the penguin.
I think, actually, you've got that the wrong way around. I think the penguin adopted him. It took realization that this person, this tall person, was actually helping him, and that little creature decided, this is going to be the one for me. And they were inseparable. And it was the exciting adventures at the school and the popularity of this little bird with all the staff, all the pupils, anyone they came into contact with, because he was just so friendly. And one of the things he says in the story, which isn't a story, is that we attribute creatures with human ways. But really, with this little thing, it was easy to do.
You learn a huge amount about penguins, as well as just the lovely story, because he becomes part of the family, really, isn't he? And all the friends, and he becomes an essential part of everything that's going on. And there's a lovely little section of the book which concerns the penguin swimming in the school swimming pool. And there's this boy, I think he's called Diego Gonzalez. And he's a very quiet boy, rather shy, probably a bit homesick, doesn't really settle very well, hasn't made very many friends. And he's a brilliant swimmer. he learns to swim alongside the penguin, and the penguin really gets him out of his shell. I thought that was a very enjoyable little section of the book.
It was lovely because he'd not been able to join any other teams in the school. And you know what those schools are like? Teams are what count. And this boy excelled. He didn't learn to swim with the bird. He was a swimmer, but it had never come to light. And encouraged by the enthusiasm of the bird, he showed his true colours and was magnificent and was taken on board by all the boys in the school. It was an eye-opener for everyone.
There's a lot there also about Argentina in the 1970s with the hyperinflation and the Perón government and all the instability, which I found pretty interesting as well. And then at the end, the last section is much, much more recent, when he goes back to visit Argentina many years after he's left and visits all the places that he knew and remembers the penguin and its position in his life. I thought that was very enjoyable.
It really was. But also a nice little touch through it was the fact that he was able to go and continue his own personal adventures and journeys because so many people loved the penguin, they were happy to foster him temporarily while he was away. And he was always greeted lovingly by the little bird when he came home. It was super. I really enjoyed it. And you could visualize the penguin and the other penguins that he came in contact with. And as you say, in the last bit when he's reviewing his life and his time with this bird, he goes to a sanctuary and meets another isolated penguin. And that's only then that he discovers the penguin cannot be released on his own. So in a way, any doubts he had, he did the right thing to look after that little penguin. Yeah. It was the right thing for those type of birds.
Yeah, well, he only discovers that late because while he's looking after the penguin, he's always a bit guilty, thinking, I've got to release him into the wild. And there were all kinds of false starts with an attempt to do that.
And he wouldn't go.
Exactly, he wouldn't go. He didn't want to go. And as you say, they need company. I think penguins mate for life, don't they?
I think probably they do. It's a very complex setup, isn't it, with those eggs and birds and finding fish and so on, yeah.
So if you want to find out all about Magellan penguins, and it's a really sweet, story.
Yes, it's a
lovely
story.
Read the penguin lesson.
We now have Aileen with her letter from a dog walker.
Dear listener, Honey Bear, my lovely honey-coloured cockapoo dog, is lying on a nearby cushioned wooden chair, using one of the arms to rest her head in the sunshine, which streams warmly through the windows. It is so lovely to feel the sun's heat as a promise of spring and summer. As you know, we take at least one long walk every day. Time passes, and each walk runs together in my memory, but every now and again there are some which remain fresh in my mind for longer. The first had been delayed by inclement weather, and it was not until well after 3 in the afternoon that we left home. As we walked up the road towards Love Lane, I stopped to talk to a neighbour whom I had not seen since Christmas Eve. We talked for some time, which meant that Honey Bear and I walked down through Muir's Park in approaching dusk, and I was reassured to know that along with dog bags and dog treats I had brought a torch in my bag. To our right, over the Sheldon skyline, dark clouds had settled, giving the impression of distant high mountains. Behind the mountains, light coming from the setting sun was orange and gold and pink and yellow. Overhead, the sky was rich royal blue, with only a few flat clouds which had absorbed the pink. As we arrived at the coast, the sea was flat calm and full of mirrored colour. Around us, people had stopped to lean on the seawall railings to enjoy the view. For a few minutes, we joined them to marvel at nature's show and then continued walking along the promenade. Honeybear enjoyed a run on the Den before we visited the post office to buy some stamps. Our return home was by number 2 bus. The following day, we were up early to be breakfasted in advance of Honeybear's 9 o'clock grooming appointment with Gina. Her fur had grown quite long, making her look a little chubby, but when I collected her, just before 11:30, she looked much slimmer and very smart. Once home, we went for a short walk along Holcombe Road behind the Minadab, where we were at little risk of her getting covered in mud. In the afternoon, I went to the Flower Club meeting and demonstration in Holcombe Village Hall, leaving Honeybear at home to look after the house. When I returned, I had with me one of the beautiful floral displays which I had won in the raffle. Another recent memorable walk was on Saturday, when we left home around midday. The day had started overcast, but by the time of our departure, the sunshine was pleasant, although it had to compete with a cold wind in open spaces. I had been concerned that Honeybear might feel the cold after her grooming, but she didn't seem at all bothered. She was full of beans as we walked up to Eastcliff Path, where we were joined by Henry and his walker Julia. Henry is a beautiful, gentle golden retriever, whom Honeybear has met on several previous walks, and they get on very well. There was no worry about Honeybear getting cold, as Henry and Honey were soon off chasing one another and stopping only to meet other dogs, while Julia and I walked and chatted. I intended to go down to the beach, so we parted company with Henry and Julia, who always complete a circle of the park before returning home. The beach was crowded with dogs and walkers. It was low tide, pleasant weather, and Saturday afternoon. We strolled as far as Spray Point. Honeybear met and appeared to recognise lots of dogs who looked as though they could be related. Cockapoos seemed to be very popular companions. It was pleasant listening to the sound of the receding tide lapping on the beach. I noticed that there had been some loss of depth to the sand, although this is not noticeable from up on the promenade. I suppose the loss is as a result of some rather rough tides over recent weeks, and it will probably be reversed with the next spell of rough weather. We walked round to W. H. Smith's for a newspaper and caught the 22 bus home from there. January usually feels a little flat, but I have managed to do lots of things, including, because I am Scottish by birth, celebrating Burns Night on the 25th of January. Yes, I had haggis, neeps and tatties. That's mashed swede and potatoes. Washed down with little whiskey, and Honeybear greatly enjoyed some haggis mixed with her evening meal. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Here's Camilla with the answers to the general knowledge quiz.
1. Which city is known as the capital of the Scottish Highlands? The answer is B. Inverness. 2. Which game is thought to have been invented in 1875 by a British Army officer stationed in India? The answer is C. Snooker. 3. Frittata means omelette in which language? The answer is A. Italian. 4. How many people usually make up a jury for a criminal trial in England and Wales? The answer is C. 12. 5. What do you call a person who climbs tall structures such as chimneys in order to carry out repairs? The answer is B. Steeplejack. 6. Which musical instrument gets its name from the Hawaiian words for jumping flea? The answer is B. Ukulele. In Hawaiian, yuku means flea and lele means jumping. 7. What is the collective noun for a group of owls? The answer is C. Parliament. 8. Which of these is not a Charles Dickens character? The answer is A. Obadiah Slope. 9. Which of the following classical composers was born first? The answer is C. Bach. 10. Which of the following is not named after a person? The answer is A. Tuxedo. Tuxedo is named after a country club. Bloomers, named after the American feminist Amelia Bloomer, and Wellington boots, named after the Duke of Wellington. Well, I hope you got 10 out of 10. If so, well, go ahead and treat yourself to a chocolate or cake or some snack, fancy snack of your choice. Okay, bye for now.
Let's find out what Lorraine and her friend Jilly have been up to in the next chapter of their diary.
Two Blondes and a Spoon Do Iceland by Jilly Pugsley. Read by Lorraine Ferguson. Chapter 4. Close Encounters with Animals. We're rattled out of sleep by the insistent clamour of a telephone. I clamber over the detritus of last night's revelry. There's a call for us. Blow! Something I'd secretly been dreading, as it can only be bad news. Lorraine gets the gist, and I ask them to put the call through. All we get is the dialing tone. We've been cut off. A myriad of things are going through our minds in a split second. And in that split second, I head towards reception like a thing possessed in my leopard skin gym jams. The confused receptionist reminds me of a trip around the island we allegedly previously booked and that the coach was waiting outside. The wake-up call had been linked to the wrong room. I walk back upstairs, my heart beating wildly but returning gradually from my mouth to its proper place. Halfway back, I'm confronted by a pink whirling dervish in the form of Bessie Maitlorraine. After visioning every possible misfortune at Long Lane Farm, she'd made for the stairs too. It took us a good hour to chill and get ourselves ready for brekkie. There's an unholy hoo-ha and cacophony emanating from the breakfast room. We're greeted by about 15 American women hockey players. Big, butch and hairy. We can't hear ourselves think. The solitary Victor Meldrew on the next table starts getting tetchy. I can notice these symptoms, having had nearly 40 years' practice with him indoors. Shut up! You can be heard in the next street. from Victor Meldrew. There's a brief lull in the chatter and some unnecessary sassiness about grumpy old Englishmen, but it does permit us to eat the remains of our breakfast in relative peace. Lorraine goes to Victor and thanks him. Creep. We leave for our daily fix at the tourist information office. Ian's rehearsal for the panto is going well. Pug wishes me happy anniversary, our 44th since meeting. I thought it was Friday, but as usual, he's right. Everything's fine. In fact, I think he's enjoying himself. We're off to the zoo and botanical gardens. Hurrah! Matt Waller is already on the case and leads me to the bus stop. But first, Lorraine needs a ladies. Unfortunately, we're halfway up the WC road. We walk a few more yards and spot what looks like a giant police box with a WC sign attached to a door. I'm sure it's actually a Wesleyan chapel. But Lorraine enters, sheepishly wishing me farewell and to have a happy life. 10 minutes later, after much gurgling, slurping and howling, Lorraine emerges from the TARDIS, as if she's had 11 rounds with Benny Hill. Was it a Wesleyan chapel, as I predicted? Yes, indeed. But the lay preacher was very pleasant and let me use his personal loo. I left him a donation. Not a deposit, then? Oh, one of those two. We're back at the bus stop, and this time Percewaller has the correct change. Happy Harrick is the driver again, and when Lorraine shows him the zoo on one of her many maps, he grunts, slowly reaches for his spectacles and sort of nods, we think. We sit next to a charming Icelander. He's on his daily trip to work and informs us that this bus driver is a miserable old what's-it and should have retired years earlier. He asks our plans for the day, and Muttwaller proudly shows him our itinerary. He looks a bit aghast, as if I got the Icelandic expression right. He explains, why would anyone want to go to the zoo? The fish museum would be much more interesting. We explain that after the whale watching and Japanese dried fish incident, we're giving fish up. He confirms we're on the right bus for the zoo, but on no circumstances should we get off until we have reached it. He bids us farewell and alights at the next stop. Now we're the only two passengers and Muttwaller has her back to the driver. 3 minutes later, the bus stops. Happy Harrick stands up and points to what I think is the north. He looks at me and quite irritably points again. Does he want me to ring the bell? Which is sort of in the direction of his pointing. I stand up and ring the bell twice. This evokes no response. I try again. But this time Lorraine, clutching her maps, has crossed her arms in a gesture of bold defiance. I am not getting off this bus. I was told to stay put and I'm simply not getting off. I'm not sure who looks crossest, Happy Harrick or Matt Waller. I think mediation would be the best policy. And as the middle exit door is open for some reason, decide that's what is wrong. I prance gazelle-like into the footwell and start grappling with the automatic doors. They won't budge. Neither will rain. The lady's not for moving. Nor is Happy Harrick, for that matter. Frustrated that my attempts at mediation have come to naught, I slide my boot under the door and tug furiously, desperate to avoid an international incident. I have never seen Lorraine this stubborn, and it would be quite magnificent were I not placed in the invidious position of peacemaker between the irresistible force of Happy Harrig and the immutable object Lorraine's become. Next, I grab hold of the pole and I'm about to adopt terrorist tactics when I'm approached from the rear by another man sporting a driver's uniform. He explains that it's Harrick's break time and he has brought the relief bus. I still don't think Lorraine's convinced, but she relents, reluctantly, gathers her maps and follows me, indignant to the end. We find the zoo after a lengthy walk through a wilderness of deserted back lanes. "And pray let us know of the wonders within," I inquire of the bemused turnstile operator. "You have seals, no doubt, walruses, the odd polar bear, methinks. Perhaps a herd or two of reindeer loping majestically in a meadow. Pray do tell. We have several chickens, two ferrets and a pig." So we make for the botanical gardens instead, which is closed for the winter. So after taking a few pickies of some enigmatic looking cabbages, we head for the hypermarket. Matt Waller confidently leads me to the appropriate bus stop, which seems like about 3 miles further on. During this time, we only see a few joggers, more joggers, and a ferret. The next bus drops us at the hypermarket. It's huge, vast, cavernous, and yet almost deserted. I've come to the conclusion that there are only three shoppers in the whole of Iceland, and they're hired by shops to give the outward appearance of bustling business. It's a curious sort of economy anyway, and difficult to understand how they can continue to exist with such a scarcity of customers. It's here that I experiment with my first Subway meal. I opt for roast beef, red onions, tomatoes, gherkins, jalapenos, beetroot, mayonnaise, mustard, pickles, cucumber, horseradish, tomato, ketchup, that is sauce and jam, all tucked neatly into a roll of honey bread. Lorraine follows suit. Perfect. We purchase a few prezzies and number 13 buys a red spotted sink plunger. He's had a fancy fall. We're quite weary by this time, so Matt Waller leads us to the next appropriate bus stop. How we manage this is one of those Icelandic magnetic mystery things, because Reykjavik has swung over on its axis again, and somehow we're going backwards. It's quite an experience. Unfortunately, the only pleasant driver in Iceland takes pity on us and puts us on a forward-bound bus. Ha! Lorraine has the window seat. Hurrah! At 5, or there again it might have been 6, depending on your position on the Icelandic theory of time, we lined ourselves up with the statutory 4 or 5 gins and headed down to the harbour to party away our last evening. The Harbour Lights restaurant had a warm, friendly atmosphere, and it was fair rocking when we joined the Connecticut and District Male Voice Choir and ice hockey team. That was when the penny dropped. There's an international match this coming weekend. The boys from Hartford, Connecticut are playing the Reykjavik Reindeers, and the hockey ladies at breakfast are playing the national female team. Number 13, probably glad of some male company, joins them for a photo shoot. Lobster tails and reindeer balls for dinner, but we decline the offer of joining the raucous throng for more pre-match partying. Bid fond farewells and skip arm in arm up the WC road, number 13 in the middle. We have absolutely no idea of the time, but as you will be aware by now, in Reykjavik, time moves in a mysterious way. Such times, Pip. Perfect.
Over to you, Valerie.
I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Exminster Hospital, of which some of you might remember. The hospital was designed by Charles Fowler using a radial plan of the panopticon type, opened as the Devon County Lunatic Asylum in July 1845. It was used as military hospital during the First World War and then became known as Devon Mental Hospital in the 1920s. It was badly bombed during the Second World War and joined the National Health Service as Exminster Hospital in 1948, before becoming known as X Vale Hospital in the 1970s. After the introduction of care in the community in the early 1980s, the hospital went into a period of decline and closed in July 1985. The main building was converted into apartments between 2001 and 2008 and is now known as Devington Park. But this little story comes from Derek Madge of Exminster Parish Council and is published in the Exminster newsletter this month. It was during some work with the Green Spaces group in the Exminster Parish Council Cemetery that the question was asked, why are these two rows next to the path with no headstones? I knew the simple answer was they were Exminster Hospital patients, buried there during the later days of the hospital when the hospital burial ground was full. Many of these patients either had no family or had been disowned by their family, so were buried in paupers' graves at the state's expense. In the later days of the hospital, it cared for older patients, and the records showed there were sometimes 6 or 7 burials a week. This led to a suggestion that it would be nice to have some sort of recognition for those patients, and a proposal to the parish council was approved to place a headstone in memory of the patients. Then COVID intervened, so some years later, I started some investigation work on old cemetery records at the Devon Records Office. This revealed that approximately 230 burials took place between August 1962 and December 1964. It was difficult to get an accurate figure as different sources were quoting different numbers, so we decided not to put a number on the headstone, just the dates during which they took place. The memorial was installed in November 2022, and there will be a dedication service at a later date. Whilst looking at the old records, I also looked through the hospital burial records for the burial ground next to Redaway Drive. Again, there were large numbers buried there, but the saddest thing I found were records of burials of young people aged between 15 and 25, and in 1911 the burial of a boy aged 7, and in 1913 a brother and sister aged 8 and 9. It is well known that treatment of mental health in the early days of the hospital was experimental, but also pioneering in the field of treatment of mental illness, as very little was known about the workings of the brain. This work eventually led to the closure of the hospital, when the need to treat patients in such institutions was no longer the best way of dealing with mental health issues.
John Townsend now shares his personal story of living somewhere he once called home.
I'm calling this new series A Roof Over Our Heads and inviting anyone to contribute. Listeners to Roundabout must be full of stories from places we once called home. Between us we have doubtless lived in all manner of spaces and shared the roof over our heads with an array of people, animals, and maybe unwanted creatures or things that go bump in the night. So I invite you to share memories of the interesting, challenging, or amusing spaces where you have chosen or been forced to lay your head. Let me start the ball rolling with a few tales from when I was a lodger and the landladies with whom I lived in digs. Should I ever write my memoirs in full, the title may well be Landladies on the Landing, as I had quite a few of them in my youth. While I was still at school, my parents abandoned me. They moved away across the country and left me behind. If a tear is already rolling down your cheek from my Dickensian start in life, it's not as bad as it sounds. In fact, ever since I delighted in teasing my parents that I would report them to the NSPCC for leaving me to fend for myself as a helpless child. To be more accurate, I was a teenager, just starting sixth form, when my father was promoted to another district. My older sister had just started a job in a bank and I was already into my A-level courses, so we were both keen to stay put in familiar territory, not least to keep an eye on our blind grandfather and his guide dog. Our parents discussed options and put the word out that we were looking for lodgings. With no social media then, it was all down to word of mouth, mainly gossip at the local post office. Reen, the postmistress, had once been a tea lady in my father's office. "Oh, fancy! I've got a couple of spare rooms in my bungalow round the corner." She never quite pronounced her R's, much to our amusement. "I'm a widow and live alone, but usually stay down the road to keep a friend company. They can stay at my place if they look after themselves and don't mind the dog." He was Danny, an intellectually challenged red setter, who would suddenly go wild when random words triggered an impulse to dig up the kitchen lino and snap at invisible flies. But a bonkers dog didn't bother us, so we duly moved in to a three-bedroom bungalow with a sitting room and a table in the kitchen for our meals. One cold day when I got in from school, I thought it would be cosy to light a fire in the hearth, so set about shovelling coal into a scuttle from a bunker in the garden. Whether it was because of the wind direction that day or a blockage in the chimney, the sitting room filled with thick belching smoke. I grappled with sheets of newspaper over the grate to draw the smoke upwards, but to no effect. Blackened and choking, eyes streaming and face kippered, I did my best to disperse the smoke clouds and ventilate the room. It had to be at that very moment when Reen appeared through the belching fumes from the French windows. "Oh, glory!" she screamed. "Whatever are you up to?" She never let me forget that day when she thought her home was being burnt down by her incompetent lodger. "Oh, you looked a proper Charlie!" Needless to say, the stench of smoke lingered throughout the rooms for days, along with a constant smell of fried onions. For Reen's signature dish at any time was curry. Whatever happened to be in the fridge invariably ended up curried, spiced and sizzling, often late into the night, while Danny chased at shadows cast by the ever-swirling steam seeping into the walls. "I've decided to have a swimming pool built in the garden. Oh, I do love a swim, I do!" And so the swimming pool was duly erected, taking hours to fill with a single hosepipe. I will well remember her climbing the steps and launching her ample frame into the pool to reach the other side in a few strokes, water cascading in torrents over the sides and turning the lawn into a marsh. "Come on in, it's lovely, truly," she called, but I chose to enter its chilly waters alone another day when tidal waves were less likely. On Friday evenings, I would catch a train to London, take the underground from Liverpool Street to Waterloo, and travel down to my parents in Hampshire, only to reverse the journey on a Sunday afternoon, back to lodger life at Reen's. Those Sundays always had a sinking feeling, but invariably I was greeted by a cheery Reen, with her feet soaking in a bowl as she worked on her shop and post office accounts in front of the television, with the aroma of curry wafting around her. "Oh, my feet ache from traipsing round cash and curry. You look bright and breezy. Think I'll have another curry." I blush to recall my college interview in a musty panelled study in front of three gowned academics. The registrar looked up from his papers and said, "I see you have two addresses, and you don't seem to live with your parents. Can you explain?" I did my best, but became tongue-tied, clumsily accounting for my weekday address and nomadic weekend arrangements. "So is your landlady your legal guardian during the week?" Well, no, not really. But then I heard myself say, well, nothing official. I only sleep with her. Faces looked up. Eyebrows rose. Oh, what I mean is, there's nothing legal about it. Well, I mean, there's nothing illegal, but, I mean, she's not there all the time, as she often sleeps with someone else nearby. One of the faces staring at me smirked. There seems to be a lot of sleeping around going on these days. I stared in horror. Oh, no, nothing like that. We don't share the same bed or anything. Oh, I wanted the floor to swallow me up as my face flushed with total embarrassment. But I probably have Reen to thank for getting me into college, as the interview panel either felt sorry for me or no doubt collapsed laughing when I left. Maybe both. Amazingly, I was offered a place. So after living at number 516 for 9 months or so, I left my sister behind at Reen's and eventually went off to college far away. We continued to stay in touch with Reen for many years, with her becoming a family friend and someone to whom I am eternally grateful. She lived to be 100, so her bizarre eating habits, sizzling onions and impromptu curries at all hours, couldn't have been all bad. Something I tend to do myself on occasions, with me cheerfully announcing, I'm just going to do a Reen. It was a totally different culinary education at my next digs, French cuisine, no less. For 3 years I lived with a French octogenarian landlady, Madame Bevere, but that's a completely different story for another time. It will have to wait till after the watershed, as, among other things, it contains confessions and nudity. So brace yourself for the next A Roof Over Our Heads, coming to Roundabout soon. In the meantime, do feel free to share with us your own tales of past homes and any nuggets from where you once lived. Don't worry, your secrets will be safe with us.
We finish with a piece of music entitled Tie a Yellow Ribbon, sung by Tony Orlando and Dawn.
I'm coming home, I've done my time. Now I've got to know what is and isn't mine. If you receive my letter telling you I'd soon be free, then you'll know just what to do if you still want me. If you still want me. Oh, tie a yellow ribbon around the old tree. It's been 3 long years. Do you still want me?
Still want me?
If I don't see a ribbon around the old oak tree, I'll stay on the bus, forget about us, put the blame on me. If I don't see a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree, bus driver, please look for me, 'cause I couldn't bear to see what I might see. Is still in prison and my love she holds the key. A simple yellow ribbon's what I need to set me free. I wrote and told her please. Oh, tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree. It's been 3 long years. Do you still want me? If I don't see a ribbon, I'll stay on.
and I can't believe I see 100 yellow ribbons round the
And it's just a few days to go to our fundraising concert on Saturday next, the 18th of February, at the Shaftesbury Theatre, Dawlish. It promises to be a fun-packed evening with songs you will know, so please join us if you're able and bring a friend. That brings us to the end of this month's programme. We would like to thank Jenny Jenkins and her guest Laura Wall, Camilla Taylor, Babs Astley, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Aileen Clarkson, Lorraine Ferguson and John Townsend.
Thanks also to Diana Corson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the memory sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor. The programme was edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith. On behalf of Valerie and myself, we hope you have enjoyed this month's edition of Roundabout and wish you well until next time.
Goodbye. Bye.